Welcome to The Weekly. I'm Jeremy.
I'm Chris.
And this week on The Weekly.
Apart from technical difficulties.
Yeah, so forgive that rocky start. You're going to see a lot of us walking around and jiggling wires before we did this. But let's talk about today Marvel using Penguin Random House as their direct market distributor. Kickstarter community head resigns over the Perfect RPG situation. San Diego Comic-Con canceled again.
Oh, okay.
Rescheduled. Kind of. So we'll see. Both of these stories about comics have conflicting updates. So it's very interesting. Yeah. And a new segment that I thought we would try, which I'm entitling, temporarily, I'm entitling Christina Strangelove or How I Learned to Stop Worrying and Love 5e.
Not going to happen.
So it's a discussion. So I found an interesting article kind of about rule structure, and I'm curious about your opinion of that and if that is one of the things that makes you not crazy about Dungeons & Dragons.
Sure.
So it's an interesting kind of examination of the evolution of RPG. All right. So let's start with this bizarre. Marvel uses Penguin Random House for their direct sales.
Okay.
So direct sales is if you see a comic book that doesn't have a barcode on it, that just has little Spider-Man's face or whatever, that's the kind that goes straight to the comic book stores, straight to direct channel retailers. So that's not Barnes & Noble, that's not the grocery store, that's not other places. And then that means they get access to variant covers and special editions and things.
Stupid question, but how do they get rung up then?
It's a different code. Yeah, it's the barcode that would go into the system of
inventory?
Book sales.
Okay,
yeah. So it's a totally different system that they're used directly. So that big barcode is if you're selling it for what do they call opposite of direct, like mainstream
direct sales?
Yeah. So and anytime you don't see it at a comic book store or at a specialty store, it's a direct sale.
Okay.
And you get it from what used to be the exclusive distributor for everyone, everything, doing all comics, which was Diamond Distributors, which we talked about during the pandemic. They had a huge...
What do you mean during the pandemic?
Beginning of the pandemic. They had a huge stumble, and DC walked away.
Yeah, I remember that, yeah.
So now Marvel is walking away.
Wow. Okay.
So they are announcing that Penguin Random House is now the exclusive worldwide distributor. So they have a multi-year exclusive... worldwide distribution agreement. And so Penguin will distribute Marvel's new comics, titles, and graphic novels to the direct market. So that is effective beginning of October, but they'll start the solicitations and everything in July so you can see what they're offering. So the quote was, and these are always wonderful, Marvel's entire history is built on telling great stories. And as we've seen for decades, those stories go hand in hand with equipping comic stores who share them. Marvel's equipping? You mean inventory is equipping? Yeah, so we're equipping the comics to the stores now. Marvel and Penguin Random House stand by that vision, and we are excited to build and expand on those opportunities for our talents, retailers, and fans. So that was the president of Marvel Entertainment, Dan Buckley. It's just silly corporate speak. Right. And this goes kind of hand in hand with last year, DC announcing that they would distribute solely through Lunar distribution as their direct sales market, severing ties with Diamond. So I think that is... And that is an ongoing thing, and DC does no longer use Diamond. Now Marvel is leaving, but later that same day, when this press release was, when this came out, Diamond released a letter that says to retailers that said that their company has struck a deal with Marvel and Diamond will continue to. So I don't know how this works.
Right. Interesting.
I don't know what's going on. They will continue to offer Marvel comic books, pre-order direct sales, graphic novels, trade collections, and everything to direct market retailers. Earlier today, Marvel announced that the company had struck an exclusive deal with Penguin Random House after 27 years of being exclusive to Diamond. It is unclear what that meant for Diamond, and now Diamond is saying, no, don't worry, they're still here. So,
wow, interesting. All right.
Who knows what that actually means and what's going to come of that.
But, had Marvel said anything about why they were leaving, or was it just the kind of nondescript we're leaving?
Yeah, just that corporate speak, it's an exciting time for comics. We've partnered with it, the significant growth. I mean, they're kind of implying they've outgrown or this is a next step because, Penguin Random House is huge. Mm. So they will have worldwide huge distribution from them as opposed to Diamond, which I think is just basically North America.
Right, okay.
But they didn't really say apart from, you know,
why,
equipping comics books and telling stories and whatever that nonsense means.
Oh, it doesn't mean anything.
Yeah.
Like, I wonder, because not being that much into comic books, I kind of wonder, like, I know there's more comic books than just Marvel and DC, mm-hmm. obviously. So those are like the biggest. So I wonder if both of those walk away, I wonder what's going to happen to Diamond. Since, I mean, mm-hmm. they're certainly not the only comic, but they're biggest, right? I also wonder, Marvel being owned by Disney.
Mm-hmm. I think this probably had something
part
to do with
it is owned by Disney. Like, is it, does Marvel only have like, does Disney only have like movie rights, or do they own all
everything.
Of Marvel?
They own everything that is Marvel. So toys and comics and everything. So basically, yeah, Marvel is just a branch of Disney Publishing now. Yeah,
right.
I think that, I'm not sure is how they exactly structured it, but I think they share, you know, they share
kind of like how Hasbro is just like a subsidiary of, or offshoot of sort of how WotC is just a branch of Hasbro.
Okay. Right, right. Yeah.
So this might not even have been Marvel's decision. It might have been Disney going.
Yeah, it might have been Disney Publishing saying, we're doing so much better. And
right.
and also the comic book market is not, I mean, aside from the pandemic, even if there was no pandemic, American comic books are dying and getting their butt kicked by Japanese manga. Like the English translation of Japanese manga dominates, you know, readers,
really?
Like young mm-hmm. readers. Yeah, one single series outsells the entire body of work being produced by American comic book creators.
Interesting. Didn't know that in tangent, but I wonder if that's because in my feelings on anime and manga side, I wonder if that's because it's cheaper, or maybe not cheaper, but more cost effective to translate 1,000 volume runs mm-hmm. of One Piece and Dragon Ball Z and all these ones that have been going for decades.
Mm-hmm.
Most of it filler, sorry. Instead of, like, it's probably cheaper and more cost-effective to translate and produce those for English-speaking market than it is to make a comic book.
Right? I don't know. It's probably with digital production, it's probably close. Because localizing, you got to make that decision. Are you flipping the art?
Right.
You know, what are you going to do? Are you going to release it to people and say, read it backwards? Because
right.
that's, you know. So I think there's a little bit of a challenge. And depending on what Japanese creators want, because this is like, Demon Blade.
Okay.
This is the newest series that's going crazy in Japan.
Oh, Kimetsu no Yaiba.
Yes, right.
The thing that my daughter sings the theme song to, despite having never watched an episode.
Yeah, it's hot with kindergarten kids, and it's like skull crushing and.
I watched the first two episodes. There is like a lot of blood in that. And anyway,
yes. Anyway,
you still don't think I had forgotten that you would have to do like licensing deals and like do write stuff to translate it.
It depends. It depends on what kind of deal they make, because there is production work to localize it. You know, you have to translate it, and you have to actually like produce those books. So I'm not sure how much depending on what if you're comparing it to some dog food titles of comic books
that tell us how you really feel, okay,
that are just just cranked out, they don't really care what's going on. It may be actually pretty close.
Oh, it might be.
Yeah.
And I certainly was not saying that localization and translation and that production stuff is cheap. I just imagined it would probably be cheap than completely developing
a
comic book from scratch.
Yeah, but people aren't paid particularly well.
No, they
aren't. As we will see in our next story about comic book industry incompetence. So how about that for a segue? The San Diego Comic-Con is once again canceled this year. And so what does that mean? That means that... So basically, there are certain creators that rely on that for up to 40% of their annual income, because they can sell prints and posters,
right.
and sketchbooks are very popular. So you print a sketchbook, which is, I don't know, like maybe 40-page, A4 single-fold stapled book. You produce that for $2 a piece, you sell it for $20 a piece. And as long as it's got your signature on it, it has value and resale value for people. And you do a thousand
print run.
Print run of 1,000, and you net 18 grand, in 1 5-day convention. And so you can do that.
You also have to sit there for a 5-day convention.
Yeah, but actually, or your girlfriend or manager can do that. But the other thing, the weird thing that's going on with San Diego is, and IO9, the website IO9, they're their headline for an article discussing this is "What the fuck, Comic-Con?"
Really? Wow. Yeah. Okay.
So yeah, WTF Comic-Con was the article that kind of caught me up on all of this. So they did cancel it, and we kind of suspected that because they canceled WonderCon, which is their spring in Anaheim, I believe, their spring by the same company managing in a smaller Comic-Con earlier in the year. But then they announced, okay, we're going to do it virtually as we did before. So July 23rd through the, I don't know, that doesn't look right. Yeah, July. So the end of July.
July 23rd through
like
June
5 9th. Days. Yeah, it was like, no, the 35th of July. So they're going to have, it's only 3 days. So it's 26th. They're going to have an online, you know, Comic-Con at home. So it's just a bunch of Twitch streams and whatever. Maybe you can, you know, communicate a little bit, but that's about it. But then they announced we will also be having a Comic-Con special edition. So the special edition will run November 26th, 27th, 28th. And wow, that's great. So it's going to be a scaled down, but an in-person Comic-Con. And the what the fuck comes from, that's Thanksgiving weekend. Mm-hmm. So you chose a weekend to have a live event, possibly that, you know, that may possibly not be canceled. We'll still be at the risk of, you know, who knows what, pandemic related, during the second busiest travel season, as opposed to Christmas, you know, in America. So
let's be honest, nerds have no family. That's not fun, right? No, okay. That's seriously really no. Bizarre. I had seen that because a lot of people on my feed were talking about like, okay, what is the deal? Why would you schedule it on Thanksgiving?
Right.
And I was kind of exposed to it from the side of, even if it's small, you're going to have like event organizers, caterers, and all these people, like all the service industry people. Who will then have to work during Thanksgiving, during a pandemic.
Yes.
Who thought this was a good idea?
Well, just like with the Marvel distribution, Comic-Con released a statement that says they are pumping the brakes on the idea of a Thanksgiving in-person event. So it was never intended to be a large gathering, reflective of the summer.
Was it a family gathering?
As a shorter event, it was our attempt to start slowly and cautiously, while at the same time addressing the desire for fans to have an in-person show. There are still many factors that are unknown to us at this time, including space accommodations, travel restrictions, capacity restrictions, required safety protocols. While open to all, with the hope that we will be able to accommodate fans from all over, we understand that due to potential travel-based restrictions and challenges, Comic-Con Special Edition may be an event attended mostly by fans more easily able to travel to San Diego. So it's a local event, I guess. So they're backpedaling. They're not canceling it, I guess, but they are saying, okay, so don't, you know, if you're on the East Coast, just kind of forget about it. Don't try to make it, you know, don't make things too complicated. But like you're saying, there's still all the union, you know, security and everything that has to operate that site. They're working that day then.
Yeah, that's real weird.
Yes.
I don't know.
Yeah,
like, so, I got nothing against like a local, and I have no problem kind of saying like, okay, we're kind of gearing this towards a specific geographic region,
right?
But to say you're going to, well, we're just testing the water, starting small on Thanksgiving.
Yeah, thanks. Let's do it on Thanksgiving.
Why is that a good idea?
But I mean, Comic-Con is such a huge source of income for so many different types of people, like in eBay scalpers and all kinds, because there's always exclusive items and products that are produced at that time. People that you can get signatures from only at that, you know, situation, in that those kind of situations. So it's going to be weird. People are not going to listen to the only local thing. They're going to come flooding in because every year they just, you know, take truckloads of items and put them on online auction sites. So that the incentive, financial incentive, is going to keep people risking that and trying to force their way into a small local event. So it seems really ridiculous.
I don't follow a lot of comic people. I guess. I don't follow comic news on social media, but just through liking art, I do follow a lot of smaller comic book or just artists in general. And so I was just hearing people talk about like conventions and stuff. I was obliquely aware of what percentage of some people's income comes from working those artist alleys and and selling the stuff they've come up with. So yeah, I'm sure the pandemic has fucked a lot of people in terms of what they would be able to make. So an in-person one, people are going to have to like weigh the pros and cons of maybe trying to make back some of the money they've lost by attending this convention versus we're probably going to still be in the pandemic and not going. So, yeah.
And with a scaled down event, how do you, so most of those indie artists are not going to be able to make it.
I'm sure they're
going to go directly to the big guys that, you know, the names that are going to help, you know, establish or keep maintain their reputations and say, okay, we've got these Marvel artists, we've got these DC artists. And it's, you know, if it's scaled down, the demand, it was already so high for a full Comic-Con that a scaled down Comic-Con, it's going to be insane. I mean, there's going to be people, you know, probably they can, you know, have some, the fees could be amazing. They could actually, like, you know,
I didn't think about that.
Yeah, do like 10 times fees, you know, booth fees and stuff just to get people there because they are so desperate to have some sort of, you know, in person thing. But yeah, so the comic industry in America doesn't seem to know what the hell it's doing. And
no,
it just
no one
has
does, really.
contradictory
press
releases for two news stories in the same week. So that was really bizarre. And both comic related. I thought that was very funny. So if you want to spend your Thanksgiving in San Diego, make your reservations now.
As opposed to home? Yeah.
And we'll just quickly touch on this because we mentioned it previously. So the Kickstarter community head quits, resigns,
moves on,
and apologizes for a controversial RPG project.
Apologize should be in quotes.
Yeah, right.
At least from my opinion.
So Kickstarter vice president and head of community Luke Crane is departing the company. So after launching and quickly canceling the controversial game project on the crowdfunding platform in February. So Crane's statement said it was a mutual decision. And so the interesting thing about it, we kind of talked about the details of this and the mysterious, you know, reverse alphabetical order by first name list of contributors to that project. So they will, I guess, be replacing him with Anya Combs is going to be their director of games outreach. But the thing that I didn't know, or a couple of things that I didn't know, is board games, TTRPGs, card games, and video games are roughly one-third of Kickstarter's revenue every year. So, yeah, about 32%. So 1 year, that's more than $230 million that is, you know, based on those game projects.
Right.
So that is a, I mean, that is something they need to carefully manage because it's a huge part of what they're doing. And the other thing that I didn't know is Kickstarter does encourage, and maybe why this things got complicated in this way, they do encourage their employees to run projects.
Really?
Yeah. So, and I don't know, maybe that's more common in the digital, because I always remembered if you're working for a service or something, it's like, yeah, you can't use this.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
You're not allowed to
say like you can use it, just you can't say anything. Or,
right, right.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, so you're not actively, you know, we can't say our employees are actively doing this, but I guess eBay and a lot of companies are openly doing that. And of course, you're going to have inside information, you're going to have access to, you know, being recommended or whatever better because you can just go talk to the programmer and say, can you put my project on the front page today? So that was a little odd, but and that may have led to, you know, this kind of thing happening. Somebody running a community, also running a project, and then trying to, like, you know, do favors for friends and things. So it's not a great idea. But
no, I think that's why you kind of don't generally are discouraged from doing that, right?
Yes.
Because even if you have the best intentions,
it
kind of ends up being messy. Like I talked before about how quickly I saw it is, or easy I see it is to slip into nepotism gang. Hey, I put out this thing. Do my friends want to work on it? Oh, that looks real bad.
Yeah, right. So. Yeah, sorry, we won't be hiring you because I have
I've hired all these friends. Yeah, yeah.
My nephew seems to be interested in this. Yeah. so that's the end of that for now. And it's Kickstarter is having a lot of silly things going on because, as you remember, they had their kind of purge of the union organizers. So they unionized in 2019 and then had some layoffs that just happened to coincide.
I had forgotten about that, yeah.
So it just happened to coincide with, oh, and you were one of the union organizers, right? Well, we don't need you anymore.
Yeah. Well, you've decided to leave, haven't you?
Yeah. So it's growing pains. I mean, if they are, you know, getting close to $1 billion of, you know, revenue in a year, I guess not that close, but like three quarters, then... they're going to have these growing pains, and stuff is going to happen. So we'll keep you posted. because it does. And that's a sad thing, though, is this is affecting and tied to the tabletop community because it's a good way for independent creators to get things out there, to kind of not have to risk, you know, as an individual that would have to put a second mortgage on their house to publish your game. You don't have to have those risks because you can gauge interest in advance.
Yeah.
Collect fees, money in advance.
I think there are kind of alternatives popping up in terms of like Indiegogo and itch funding. And I guess also for, my brain turned off, also for Kickstarter, just through some people I follow, Kickstarter is not available if for you to be a creator in an overwhelming number of countries, right? So it's also kind of like, on the one hand, sure, it is this great tool that people can use to produce something that they would not ordinarily have been able to fund. Mm-hmm. But on the other hand, it's not accessible to a wide swath of creators across the world, which is kind of a problem.
Yeah.
I'm sure it's nothing to do with Kickstarter, but just kind of like how things get electronically paid for and yada, yada, yada. And they're probably beholden to like PayPal and all these other kind of stuff, but it's still not great.
Yes. And we have frozen.
Oh, look at that. I wasn't paying attention.
So let me see.
No one can see the thumbs up I just gave. Yeah.
If I can get us back. Hey, we're back.
Okay, there we are. Cool.
Oh, sorry.
Now everyone can see my gesticulation. And this is why we need to hire someone to watch the stream.
Hey, we've got Joe. Joe just said you guys are frozen.
Too bad we weren't looking at it.
Yeah. Right. Thank you, Joe. Yeah. The discussion and the peripheral vision thing is a little difficult. All right, so now we're moving.
I still try and talk to you like it's a conversation rather than this way. Yeah.
So that's how much we didn't care about that Kickstarter story. We didn't even move when we were talking about it. All right, so let's move on to this kind of last thing. Ooh. So I just had this idea of, as topics came up that I thought were kind of interesting, in tabletop, I wanted to bring them up with you and kind of get your opinion, and it'll help.
It all
kind
sucks. How about that?
It'll be kind of like playing Battleship. It's like, is this it? No, hit, miss. Like, am I getting close to like?
I cheat. I don't actually put my ships on the board.
Yeah, that's right. You get your ships in your pocket
miss,
the whole time.
Miss.
I'm entirely white pins on my board here, but. So inspired by the full title of Dr. Strangelove. So Christina Strangelove or How I Learned to Stop Worrying and Maybe Explain My Hatred of 5e, something like that. Yeah, something about your relationship with 5e. So there was another interesting Cannibal Halfling gaming post, and they've got a really interesting blog. Sometimes I really get stuck on some of the pieces that they write because they bring up interesting things. And this is talking about kind of the role of the GM, the DM in a game and how it was established with Dungeons and Dragons and then how it's evolving.
Okay. Yep.
And so, so the kind of beginning of things, we're talking about, board games, everyone's following the same rules and you're going for this victory condition for the most part.
Yeah, for the most part. Whether it's against the board or against the other players, right. I'd say that's pretty accurate.
And so then something like wargaming then expanded that to have a game that had a rule set, but then had changing scenarios and victory conditions. So you're kind of playing a board game where everybody understands what your units or what your pieces can do, but you can change the kind of what you're doing from a capture the flag to a kill everybody on the other side. So objectives can kind of change.
Okay, so kind of like same rule set, different objectives.
Right. Okay. And so then. Role-playing coming out of wargaming started to also play with that idea. So they talk about the first, like the earliest Bronstein campaigns kind of walked away from that idea of a simple win-lose condition for victory, for an objective. And because it was kind of based on diplomacy, kind of that model. So that there was negotiation and diplomacy happening that people didn't know about. So moving parts that kind of manipulated things in the game. And it wasn't win or lose. So obviously it wasn't, a on-off kind of state.
Right.
So every traditional role-playing game from the first edition of Dungeons & Dragons onward has had rules for the players and then separate rules for the person running the game.
Okay.
Basically, you have the player's handbook and the Dungeon Master's Guide. You're all kind of, that world has to have understandable mechanics that the players can do. The DM knows what they are, but it's kind of, very different rules that you're running the game by. So the strange thing, though, that happened that this article talks about from the very beginning of Dungeons & Dragons is it wasn't very clear as a DM how you run the game. Like
right.
the okay. explanation of the game right. was a little vague. And so it became kind of a tribal oral history kind of process where it's like once you were brought in as a player and saw somebody run the game and say, wow, I love how they did, but I would do it like this. You know, it became this knowledge that was passed on and never written right. out. And so it was kind of, you know, teach when like run one, teach one is basically what you're doing at the same time. So that combination of like written and then tribal knowledge created this barrier to entry
okay.
of early role playing that I think what more recent role play systems are trying to get around. So that, you know, so that kept a barrier to entry. But then you had things like starting in 2000, you had things like Burning Wheel came out in mm-hmm. by Children of the Forge, and that had specific mechanics to help the GM kind of craft what story the players wanted to tell. Apocalypse World in 2010, the GM gets their own set of rules, or their own set of moves mm-hmm. that are in parallel to the player moves.
Right.
So they are, and so that evolution is a little bit about the GM doesn't need separate rules that are completely invisible to the players. He just needs to. So he is just another kind of player, I think, is the more modern thinking of that.
Well, I guess you're right. And looking at Apocalypse World and then reading Dungeon World, something kind of clicked when I read Dungeon World. I mm-hmm. went, oh, like if you're running a D&D game, mm-hmm. I saw a lot of people kind of balk at the idea of GM moves, and I said, when I finally figured out, I said, GM moves are not anything different from what you do when you're running a game of D&D.
Mm-hmm.
They're the best practices just very now good. Codified right. as sort of a set of things the GM does. And that's mm-hmm. when I went, oh, right. Okay, I kind of understand what GM moves and all these moves do now.
Nice.
But I even broke Brighthammer into three little books just to mirror D&D.
Yes, yes.
I think there's, for some types of games... Mm-hmm. The GM rules are rules that the players don't need to know.
Mm.
And that doesn't mean they shouldn't know.
Right.
It's just, largely speaking, most traditional games, players run one character. And mm-hmm. so the rules for running that character are all they really need to know to play the game.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas the GM is pretty much in charge of everything else, mm-hmm. like the weather, travel times, all that stuff. So I kind of understand why there would be some separate rules for the GM, only because... giving them to everybody has the potential to be information overload.
Mm-hmm. And also so. Rules lawyering. It said here D6 for the rain.
I think that's a completely different thing. But I think what it is possibly, I'm trying to think of the relation word. I think that's one of the effects that having a separate set of rules for the person who runs the game as opposed to the play of the game. Like, rules lawyering can come out of that, and mm-hmm. the antagonistic GM thing kind of can come out of that, because I have this secret tome of rules that are just for me
right.
that you don't get to look at, and it says here that I can do this, right?
Right, right.
So I think that that's an effect, not necessarily in all cases, mm-hmm. but definitely a possibility.
Yeah. Right, right. Yeah, so it talked about that basically, you know, in early role-playing, the DM's role is, explaining... first
what
figuring
you see.
Out so what the players need to know for the activity of what yep. they're doing, and basically that's because of the name, it's kind of in the name, in exploring dungeons, killing monsters. Mm. So you have to know combat, you have to know investigation, and then the other role of the other rules that a game master would need is, how do you stage those activities?
Right.
Like, how do you determine difficulty, how do you determine what opponents show up, and then, how those rules would then apply to them. So the interesting thing that they said that may have come from the very beginning, kind of the business model of early role-playing, once it became TSR and they were publishing, they're trying to sell books, is they don't want to teach you, they don't want to give you a set of rules for creating your own adventures very specifically, because they've got modules
right,
that they want
right.
to sell. So, a module kind of takes... a lot of the how-to out of DMing by saying lead the players through
right.
this, and so there wasn't a need. I mean, and you could, so, but then that kind of reverse engineering, like playing a couple of modules, running players through a party through a couple of modules that you like, say, okay, now I think I get what they're
right.
doing, and reverse engineering kind of became the style. And I think that's why the tribal knowledge of, you know, DMing, that's where that comes from, is people kind of tearing apart what what was presented as, you know, this is an adventure for this game, and figuring out how to do that yourself. But there was no encouragement to do that. And I think more recently there is, like, people are just giving, if you look at games like Troika, like a very sandbox game that's just letting you kind of go crazy and interpret things however you want, like what a warrior is, what a dark empire is, you know, you can just completely leave it to the player's interpretation. So it's kind of stepping away from that. So I thought that was, it was interesting. So the again, they talked about Apocalypse World, and basically Apocalypse World, the system is just telling you how to structure threats that will drive conflict in your story, which is very different from, you know, running a module, like when you're taking people through an adventure.
A to B to C.
Yeah. Right, right. And it takes a huge step towards casting, and I think I've mentioned this, cast the GM as a different kind of player rather than a singled out person that has to write and host a game. Mm. And that, so low prep, I think, is a thing that's kind of evolved with.
Not that I'm necessarily turned off on low prep, but I kind of assumed low prep as well. But then I think I now subscribe to the idea, and we're still not frozen, okay, cool, that there's different kinds of prep. Mm-hmm. Because as many times as I say online where I improv fucking everything, right? And I sound kind of snooty when I say it, and just like roll up having going, I got a list of names and that's fucking it. So let's go. The prep has come from a kind of not necessarily researching the genre, but like brainstorming ideas, or, you know, in downtime coming up with things or people they might encounter or might happen, or even putting together like a Pinterest board of blasted landscapes to run Apocalypse World. Mm-hmm. So it's a different kind of prep, but saying low prep kind of says it's, or can lead to the impression that it's less important or more important than other kinds of prep.
Right.
So I've kind of, not soured, but moved away from saying low prep to just kind of saying it's a different kind of prep than reading through a module to figure out how to run a game.
I think it's interesting. people and tastes are kind of evolving and changing. And there's also, you know, that push, kind of the indie scene is also pushing people back to kind of OSR. And a lot of the things that's coming up with OSR is kind of rehabilitating the use of tables, you know, creating interesting tables that give the flavor of a world and using those to craft things. So you're not running through a linear adventure that you're railroading players through. You're kind of letting things kind of, you know, bounce off each other. And as long as the table has a, you know, is thematic or has a structure or is like at least makes sense in that world, you're not going to have random events that couldn't possibly
happen. Or you might, like some of the early D&D modules where you walk into a room and there's like a poster to reelect Nixon on the wall or something. You remember that? Or like a random like modern era newspaper on the floor? Because I mean, it gets to kind of like the jokey nature of original D&D where you're exploring a spaceship. But yeah, I think you're right. Like tables can kind of spark interest, or you kind of go back to tables where they facilitate a more improvisational style of GMing, where the GM can go, I don't know what's going to happen. Oh, this happens. Mm-hmm. And then, like, it doesn't do all of the work for you because you still then have to, like, usually flesh that thing out or find out a reason for that thing being there when the players go, what is it doing here? And you have to, like, make something up on the spot. But it's just, like, another tool to kind of reduce the amount of prep you have to do maybe before the game,
right.
rather than during the game.
Yeah, no, that's true. Yeah, and I've even heard, so that's the thing I think that's helping affect this and helping disseminate that tribal knowledge is YouTube and actual plays and things. You can, without ever experiencing, not even owning any of their books, never having played the game, you can watch someone play almost any system that's out there and see, you know, how that how a session of that feels, you know, with that particular group, but see how they're doing things to see to find out if that's even something you would want to do.
Which group definitely affects that.
Yeah,
I've noticed that for me, because like I said before, the kind of the primary reason I watch APs is mostly to see how a system plays. Mm-hmm. And for some people, their primary goal is entertainment.
Right.
And sometimes I've like watched an AP and gone, I don't know how to play this game because you're not actually playing it, right? You're just kind of sitting there bullshitting with each other, which is totally fine. Like, if that's what you want to do, not why I want to watch.
Right. And one of the DMs that talks a lot, it kind of like is making their own perfect version of Dungeons & Dragons, like has the memories of what they liked about what they played and is kind of making their own version of it actually doesn't even show the player's handbook and just says, you know, what kind of character do you want to do? What kind of spells or abilities do you want to have? And they just ask them, so what do you do in that situation? Right. And they are just kind of narratively saying that. And he's like, okay, let me figure out mechanically how that should work. And so taking away completely the mechanics of the players and just giving them a interactive kind of storytelling experience, but still having the mechanics right. of that game, you know, happening behind the scenes. So yeah, there's a lot of different kind of approaches.
That can absolutely go either way. And I've actually done that approach because I remember back when we were playing 4E trying to introduce a new player, I said before, like we played Twilight Imperium 3, I think, like with this player mm-hmm. board game. So they were not shy about just diving into a massive rule book. But before the game, we said, here's the player's handbook. Boom, make a character. And they looked at it and went, nah, brah, like, I'm done. And like that really taught me, like, that's not going to necessarily translate over. And so what other times I've introduced people to the games, I've sometimes handed them a player, like a trimmed down moves sheet, because we were playing Dungeon World.
Right.
And sometimes I see like their eyes glaze over and I go, okay, never mind. Let's turn that over for right now. What kind of character do you want to make? Mm-hmm. And then going, okay, what do you want to do? So I've done that as well. Mm-hmm. Kind of the, oh, this seems scary to you or intimidating. Let's just take that away and show you that that's kind of ancillary to what we're doing or not necessary. I mean, it can be abused mm-hmm. from the GMs that go, oh, you don't get to know the rules or don't get to see anything, you know?
Yeah.
But yeah, I think it depends on the group and the player.
Yes, yeah,
but
yeah,
definitely. I still want to do a horror game where it's like, nope, you don't know anything about your
Yes. Friends. Yes. Yeah, right. Yeah, that's true. And I think especially maybe for younger players, not having them dealing with mechanics would be really fun because they would kind of understand what you're trying to do in the session. And then as they're older and can do the math and everything, they can start to enjoy that.
Yeah.
But so going back to the theme sure. of your love or hatred of 5e, so 5e has, it seems, gone back to that kind of taking away, because we got to sell Ravenloft and we got to sell Temple of Elemental Evil, like, you know.
Redux.
take away how to do this, where the community is kind of like showing you examples, and there's a lot of YouTubers that are really talking about being a good GM, what types of things to do, like little tricks and approaches to handling a character or NPC creation and things that make it easier. So is that one of the things about Dungeons and Dragons that's just like, that weird, there's a correct way to DM. We're not going to tell you what it is, but there is. Yeah.
Not like that. That is not one of the reasons I dislike D&D. Mm-hmm. It's certainly there. I think D&D is affected by the fact that it's a corporately backed game, right? And I think WotC doesn't actually need to make an official here's how to make a module product, or they don't actually need to do that because the fans are doing it for them.
Right.
Through things like DM's Guild, like, much as I don't like it as a consumer from a business point, it makes sense for them to go, we don't have to make all these things because the DM's Guild is doing it for us, right? They're kind of like plugging in, voluntarily plugging in the holes in kind of our catalog to teach people how to run. So let's just keep making these things that people are obviously buying.
Right. And they're getting a cut. So it's not like it's homebrew that they, you know, that's just kind of being passed around. That's very
DM's Guild, like, we'll let you use our stuff, our IP. Mm-hmm. We'll take a large cut and kind of say yes or no if something gets real out of line.
But you have immense credibility then if you're publishing.
We'll also dangle this carrot of maybe using your stuff in a published, you know, published adventure, or maybe bring you on as a freelancer, and then go, never mind. I'm not cynical.
So interesting. As these kind of things come up and people are talking about, you know, kind of the contrast and evolution, I'll keep bringing these things up and we'll kind of see if we can figure out exactly. I mean, I definitely think I understand the corporate angle of it because they're just interested in selling dice and books and pre-printed miniatures, and that contaminates.
Even if the people who work on the project have altruistic goals in mind and actually love the game, stuff is still kind of tainted somewhat from it being run by a giant toy conglomerate.
Yeah, they want to sell toys.
Yep, that's it. And I can't blame them for it, but I can still go, cool, not buying it.
Right. Yes. So we have the the Mother's Screen
The
Alien RPG on the table. And I was going to pass that off to you, but you said that, yeah, there may be
some due to the rising coronavirus numbers in Osaka, the game may be canceled.
Mm.
Possibly, possibly not. But I still would like to use it if it is not. And I think I'll find out fairly soon.
Okay, cool.
But that does give me more time to come up with all the stuff
for
the adventure, which I kind of been slacking on. Yeah.
Very cool. Yeah. So yeah, I hope that happens, and I hope we hear about it after it happens. So So where can people find you?
On Twitter, as always. That's HiveMind, HYVEMYND. I've actually put Conan the Sailor Man on hiatus because work just sucks and there's no interesting stuff that's come out of it. I have started doing my solo Ironsworn game again though.
Oh, cool.
At a reduced 2-a-day post.
Nice.
Just because I started watching the History Channel show Vikings again, and I got, this is pretty cool. You know what game I could play this in? Ironsworn. All right, let's go back to that. Yeah.
Excellent. Oh, that's very cool. So that's on your main Twitter account?
Nope, that's a separate one that I guess I'll put a link
to. We'll give a link to everything that you're up to, and as well as your Itch channel as well, so people can check out Brighthammer. All right.
Cool.
So, yeah, that will do it for this week. And sorry, it was so...
we only froze once.
Yes.
We noticed.
We froze at the beginning and we froze in the middle. But we were talking about Kickstarter, so it doesn't need gesticulation, I guess, to...
I can't not gesticulate.
So thank you for joining us. And I will jump on the chat after Chris departs, so I will catch up with everybody that was watching. And thank you again for helping us through the technical difficulties at the beginning. I'll trim those off, of course, for the audio version so you don't have to hear in your podcast. And we will be back next week. If you'd like to support this podcast, please consider becoming a patron. So patreon.com/idleredhands.
Aren't they called weaklings?
Yes. Pledge as a weakling and we will know that you are enjoying what we're doing. We'll be back next week. See you then.
Later, mortals.
Goodbye.